Bruce has been speaking on creation evolution topics, I guess, at least for 10 years or so. And so he's not new to this. He's spoken at our forum a number of times. And he also sponsors a few meetings of speakers down where he lives in the Edgewood area, down south of here. And so tonight he's going to speak on the topic of the quest for evolution. And as you'll see by his slides, this is getting to where did evolution really start? Who really founded that? Was it really Darwin? Or is there somebody else that we should know about that has funded that? So with that, let's invite Bruce to come up and speak on that topic.
Thank you, Heinz. Tonight, the quest for evolution. And thank you, Heinz, for inviting me. I've been researching this topic for some time, and I found it really fascinating. But on the way up here, Ron Payne back there was kidding me about my age. And I guess he's right. I'm not getting any younger. In fact, I'm so old, I can remember when the Dead Sea was still just sick. But I intend to live forever. So far, so good. But no, seriously, when I die, I'm donating my body to science fiction. Well, speaking of science fiction, we're going to talk about evolution. It's often said that in order for us to know where we're going, we need to know where we've been. And I think this is true about evolutionism. Evolution's deeply rooted in our culture, but how did we get to this place? And by the way, there's a handout going around where you can kind of follow along what I'm saying. Anyway, most people assume that evolution began with Charles Darwin in 1859. But as I began to research the subject, I was astonished to find that, no, Charles Darwin didn't really come up with anything new at all. It goes back thousands of years. And so I invite you to join me tonight as we travel back in time and find out, where did this idea of evolution actually start? It seems like whenever people reject God, arises to take its place, something in their mythology that usually involves some thread of evolution. And so tracing back in history, as far as recorded history goes, we find some mentions of evolution. So why did I call this the quest for evolution? Well, I think a scripture will give us some ideas. 2 Peter 3:5, for this they are willingly are ignorant of that by the word of God the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. And the part I want to emphasize is where it says they are willingly ignorant. It seems like whenever people reject their creator, they're being willingly ignorant and they're going to fall prey to something else. And a lot of times it's evolution. But it's nothing new. Ecclesiastes 1:9, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. We're going to see that evolution is nothing new. And so we're going to go back to in time to about 4,000 years ago. There's a group. Well, before I go into that, let's look at a map of the ancient Near East. This is the area that they call the cradle of civilization. The Tower of Babel was in that area someplace, and it's not far from where Noah's Ark probably landed. But we're going to be looking at the ancient Greeks, Greece up here, Egypt, Babylonia, and Sumeria, and also India, which is off of this map, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But let's go back to the earliest beginnings. We can trace evolutionary thought back to probably about 2000 BC, 4,000 years ago. There was ideas of this, and I suspect even farther back, but this is far as recorded history goes. There was a group known as the ancient Pelasgians. Who were they? Well, they were apparently the predecessors of the Greeks. They settled the area of Greece before Greece became a nation. What did they believe? Well, they believed that the universe was eternal, very similar to some of the things that we've been told today. There are several theories for the origin of the universe. One, the oscillating universe theory, and another, the steady state theory, both of which are kind of falling out of favor, but they both said that the universe was eternal. But the thing I found even more interesting was this other belief. They said that there was a pre-existent chaotic matter out of which sprang a cosmic egg. And when this cosmic egg split in two, it produced the sun, the moon, and the earth, and everything that's on it. Well, does that sound familiar? Well, the Big Bang theorists tell us that the Big Bang happened from a cosmic egg that exploded and technically inflated, but eventually produced the sun, the moon, the earth, and everything on it. So as we go along, try to picture the parallels between the ancient beliefs and what they're telling us in the textbooks now. And I think you'll be amazed at the fact that Darwin didn't really have anything new to say. Let's go back to ancient Sumeria, about the 18th through the 16th centuries BC. They have discovered a series of clay tablets called the Enuma Elish, which, in addition to other things, talks about origins. One of the things that they say was that all things evolved from water. Now keep that in mind, because that's a common theme throughout all of these ancient cultures. So let's go to Babylonia. Now Babylonia succeeded Sumeria, so we're going ahead a little bit in time, but they thought the earth was ancient. They thought it was 490,000 to 730,000 years old. Today, of course, we're told that the earth is ancient. They also thought everything evolved from water. And this cylinder seal that I'm showing you here shows their god Enki. That was the Sumerian god. The equivalent Babylonian god was known as Ea. But it shows him emerging out of water. So they thought water was creative. They thought it was divine, and that everything evolved from water, including their gods. Well, this strikes me as sort of familiar, because what does Darwinian theory say? Well, it says that life emerged from water. So they really had that concept a long time ago. How about the ancient Egyptians? Well, they thought it was 155,625 years since creation. And they thought that the world emerged from an infinite, lifeless sea. Again, that theme of water. One variant of their cosmology story says that the world emerged from a cosmic egg. Again, sort of like Big Bang that we're told about today. But they also thought that snakes, frogs, worms, and mice came from the mud of the Nile when it overflowed. And you say, well, that's silly. Of course, nobody believes that today. That's been long since disproven. That's called spontaneous generation. But when we stop to think about it, the ancients believed that it came from mud. What do the evolutionists tell us today? That the prebiotic ooze, or the prebiotic, or yeah, the primeval mud, or whatever you want to call it, brought forth the first life. And eventually it evolved into sea creatures, and then they crawled out onto land and evolved into mammals and so forth. So actually what they were saying was, snakes, frogs, worms, and mice, today, they say, they evolved from the primordial ooze. It just took millions of years. Well, when I think about ancient Greece and in Egypt and so forth, in relation to ancient India, I think, well, yeah, India, that was far away and probably didn't have much to do with the Near East. But in reality, all these cultures had an interchange of ideas. They had commerce, and I came across this map showing trade routes between Rome, the Greeks, and India down through the Arabian Gulf. And so a lot of these cultures exchanged ideas. They had very similar beliefs because they were talking to each other. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the Greek philosophers studied under the Brahmin priests of India and the Chaldean priests and so forth. So let's look a little bit for a moment at what the Hindus believed. They believed that the earth was ancient. Brahman, who represented the universe, was once the size of an atomic particle and expanded to form the primeval matter 4.3 billion years ago. And when I saw this, I was astounded. Where did they come up with this number 4.3 billion years? Because what do geologists tell us today? The Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. But how about this? They thought that everything was the size of an atomic particle at one time that expanded. What does the Big Bang say? There was a singularity or a cosmic egg which exploded and formed everything that we have today. It just took 13.8 billion years. They believed in spontaneous generation of life from the oceans. Again, there's that theme of water. And of course, again, biologists assume that life sprung up from water today. And they believed that evolution to higher forms by animals was possible by the animal's own will, which reminds me sort of Lamarckianism. Now, if you're not familiar with that, this kind of predated Darwin, but the way it's usually illustrated is you picture, say, an animal the size of a horse, and this animal grazed on leaves on trees and wanted to reach the highest leaves on the trees, and so he stretched and stretched his neck over many generations, and the neck grew gradually and over many generations reached the size of the giraffe. So that theory is outmoded, but it reminded me of this ancient belief. Well, they also believed in reincarnation to higher forms of life if you had good karma. I only include this because it reminds me of evolution. Scaling the ladder of evolution a step at a time towards higher life forms. So if we were to summarize the ancient ideas of the Greeks, or excuse me, not the Greeks, but the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Hindus, and the Egyptians, and put them together with our modern equivalents, this is what we would get. They believed in an eternal universe. There was the oscillating universe theory or the steady state universe theory, which correlates to that. They believed the Earth was ancient. Today we're told it's 4.6 billion years old. They thought the Earth or the universe sprang from a cosmic egg or particle. Today that's what the Big Bang advocates tell us. They thought everything evolved from a watery chaos. Today we're told that life evolved from water, from the prebiotic soup. All right, so with that then, let's go on to ancient Greece. This map shows a picture of Greece, what it might have looked like about 500 BC. And let's take a look at some of the beliefs of the Greek philosophers. As I mentioned earlier, they borrowed heavily in their beliefs from the Hindus, the Babylonians, and the Egyptians. They thought the universe was old. They believed generally in the spontaneous generation of life, especially the lower life forms. They thought everything evolved from one substance, usually water, but sometimes other things. And they even came up with a form of natural selection. Now, everybody associates natural selection with Darwin, but here we're talking about 1500 BC or so, They're already talking about natural selection. I'm going to go into that a little bit more as we go on. So what were exactly some of their ideas concerning the age of the universe, the age of Earth? Well, Plato, for instance, thought there were 200 million years from the flood to his time. Where did he get that number? I don't know, but that's what he said. Aristotle was a student of Plato. He thought the cosmos and the earth were eternal, and if that was the case, then there couldn't have been a designer. Now, this was early in his life. Later on, he changed his mind. He thought maybe that there was some kind of an intelligent designer. But anyway, here's another interesting parallel that I found. The ancient Greeks, typified by a philosopher by the name of Democritus, thought that there must be countless inhabited planets, they called them worlds, out there someplace. Now, their thinking along this line corresponded more to what today is called the multiverse theory. If you haven't heard of that, some cosmologists think that there may be many universes in different dimensions with different physical constants than ours. We just happened to be in the right one where everything worked out perfectly so that evolution could take place and that we could sit here and think about multiverses. But anyway, that's sort of what the Greeks were thinking. And Democritus, for instance, thought that the universe was boundless, that it went out forever. Well, cosmologists today tell us that we live in an unbounded universe that extends forever. He thought that there must be an endless number of worlds evolving and deteriorating. And today, one of NASA's chief goals is finding life out there someplace. Where did we come from? And to date, they've found about 3,000 what they call exoplanets, that is, planets revolving about stars, but no life yet. And Democritus also thought, well, any of these worlds could be destroyed by collisions with another one. And that reminded me of one of the hypotheses about the formation of our moon. It goes like this. One day, a giant asteroid collided with the Earth, knocked off a chunk of Earth, which started rotating around the Earth and became our moon. Well, there was a common belief among the ancients that the universe and or the earth were actually living. The poet Hesiod, for instance, thought that initially there was a shapeless mass which brought forth earth or Gaia. Gaia was the ancient earth goddess. Why do I bring that up? Because today, some otherwise serious scientists think that they subscribe to something called the Gaia hypothesis, which says that the Earth is a living organism. This is especially popular with the New Agers. Then there is a philosopher by the name of Thales who said that all things are full of gods. This is a form of pantheism which says, God is in everything, you're God, I'm God, this building is God, and the trees are God, and everything else, like the force, I guess. Well, then there's Pythagoras and some of the others. You may remember Pythagoras from the Pythagorean theorem of high school algebra, but he talked about a lot of other things besides mathematics. One of the things that he subscribed to, along with some of the others, was that there must be some cosmic mind out there someplace ordering all things. Plato and Aristotle also thought that the universe was living. In fact, here is a representation from medieval times called Spheres of the Cosmos, which represents the thinking of Aristotle, or at least pretty close to it. But it sort of corresponds with the geocentric theory, which says that Earth is in the center, and then everything else is in concentric spheres around the Earth, the planets and the stars and so forth. And going out to the outside, the outer ring represents some intelligent force. This is what Aristotle came to believe later in his life, that there must be some intelligence out there someplace. Most of the ancients believed that everything came from one substance, particularly typified by Homer, the Greek poet, maybe 1000 BC. Many of the Greeks, as I mentioned, thought everything came from water. Some said air, one said fire, but generally water, just as biologists tell us today that life originated in water. And then there's a school called the Atomists. Now, they believed that originally the universe was full of atoms that were just churning around, and these atoms just happened to collide together, and some of them stuck together, and the ones that stuck together formed different things and were responsible for everything in the universe, including Earth. How does that correspond to what we're told today? Well, we're told that everything formed by random chance processes. This was a random chance process that they advocated. How about the origin of life? Well, again, the philosopher Thales was the first one, apparently, to propose that life originated in water. And he said that all life forms came about by a chance process of self-assembly. It's interesting that Thales lived in Egypt for a long time and absorbed many of the Egyptian beliefs on evolution. If we were to put his beliefs together like this, water, he said, evolved into inorganic elements, and then they evolved into plants, and then animals, and then man. That's not too much different from what they're telling us today. They're telling us today that water brought forth the first life, which then crawled out on the land and evolved into us eventually. Another interesting philosopher was called Anaximander, and he also believed that life was from water, but he added an interesting twist to it. He said that the sun, acting on the primal mud, generated these sea creatures. Now, some of these sea creatures were actually fish-like forms with prickly scales, which eventually evolved into humans and crawled out onto land and shed their scales, and humans developed from there. Well, again, this theme that life originated in water and came out onto land. Empedocles is called the father of evolutionary naturalism. So this is a good point to define naturalism, because science today is based upon materialism and naturalism. Now, naturalism says that everything has a natural cause, especially the origin of the universe and nature, the earth. Nothing supernatural can be admitted. As a matter of fact, scientists kind of play a game. They say, let's see how far we can go toward explaining everything naturalistically. No divinity allowed. And they also say that all knowledge is empirical, that is to say, based upon observation and experience, and therefore science is our only reliable path to knowledge. Creationism, therefore, has no place in science. It's unscientific, and it has to be excluded from serious discussion. Well, again, Empedocles had some other things to say. He thought that spontaneous generation explained the origin of life, but he added something else. He said that originally in the prebiotic soup, there were all these body parts floating around, heads and arms and legs and eyes and torsos, and they all just happened to come together in the right combinations. At least some of them did. The ones that didn't work out perished. Now you say, that sounds stupid. Of course, nobody believes that today. But this was a precursor to Darwin's theory of natural selection and survival of the fittest, because he said the combinations that worked, that is, the ones that were fittest, survived. The ones that didn't were selected out. And so we have a hint here of natural selection. Evolution by random processes. Democritus, again, he said that nothing exists but eternal matter. And this is sort of like the materialism that we're taught today, that everything is material. But he also thought, because everything was random, the universe has no purpose. We're just random accidents in space, as they tell us today. Everything evolved by blind necessity. If something needed to evolve to fill a certain function, it would evolve. And, get this, he said, spiritual values, including morality, can be reduced to atoms. This is called reductionism, which says that everything depends on physical processes. It's like saying that life is just chemistry. We're just sophisticated piles of chemical reactions walking around, nothing more, nothing less, no meaning to it. Boy, isn't that comforting. Plato introduced a concept called the Great Chain of Being, which persisted for many centuries. And the way he envisioned it, he arranged life from the highest form down to the lowest form. And he thought that there was some sort of a reverse evolution. They thought that the species were fixed, that not that one could evolve into another, but he thought that the higher life forms gave birth to the lower ones. In other words, the lower life forms emerged from the higher ones successively. And sort of that was sort of the chain that he pictured. Aristotle had a similar concept, which he called the scale of being. Here's a medieval representation of Plato's great chain of being. Now, it's a little bit hard to see in this diagram, so I've labeled it. In this particular one, this is medieval, so they had God at the top and hell at the bottom. Now, Plato's diagram just had some sort of divinity at the top. He didn't know exactly what it was, and earth at the bottom. The interesting thing was this arranging things in a scale sort of gave the inspiration later on to geologists to formulate the geologic column. Like I said, this concept persisted throughout the Middle Ages, and was also believed by Heraclitus, but he also came up with another concept of natural selection. He said that random changes led to upward development through a struggle for existence in a form of natural selection. Oh boy, that sounds like it's right out of Darwin, but we're talking 2,500 years or so ago. And incidentally, Heraclitus was kind of an interesting guy. Unlike the other philosophers of his day, he didn't have a school, he didn't have students following him. He apparently was a hermit living out in the woods by himself someplace, and reputedly he lived on grasses and plants. So the only reason we know about him today is that his writings have survived. Well, speaking of natural selection, Empedocles also spoke on this. He had a view very similar to that of Heraclitus. He also believed that natural selection and acting on random changes was the primary mechanism of evolution. Again, sounds like Charles Darwin, but we're talking thousands of years ago. The only difference today is, Neo-Darwinism says that it's natural selection acting on random mutations. Well, they even had a concept of societal evolution. Again, Democritus. He said that society evolved in stages. We started with the hunter-gatherer stage and gradually learned to make fire and invented the wheel and gradually learned to domesticate animals and how to farm and so forth. All this by trial and error. He also thought that language began with grunts and eventually evolved into words and finally a written language. When I read this, I was blown away because guess what they're teaching in Anthropology 101 today in college? This exact same thing. When I took it many years ago, I thought, oh yeah, sounds logical, must have happened that way, and I ate it all up. Well, what they've come up with and what they're teaching in the textbooks today is exactly what Democritus was saying thousands of years ago. Nothing new there. Xenophanes also was a precursor to today's evolution. He looked at the fossils and the fossil record, and he saw a succession of geologic ages and of life. He didn't assign millions of years to them yet, but he saw evolution happening there. How about the source of knowledge? Where does our knowledge come from? Well, Epicurus, you may remember him from Epicureanism, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Well, he had a lot of other things to say. He was a materialist, and he said that sensation is the sole source of knowledge, which many other philosophers picked up on later on. And so materialism says that this material world is all there is. If we can't taste it, touch it, hear it, smell it, or see it, or detect it or measure it in the laboratory, is not real. There is no spiritual dimension. Material, eternal matter is all there is. And therefore, there's no existence beyond our present life. He also said that life is only a special form of physical energy, just a movement of matter. It's interesting that Paul, in Acts chapter 17, reasoned with the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. So again, if we were to sum all this up, compare it to today's beliefs concerning evolution, these parallels are striking, really fascinating to me. They believed that the universe and or the earth were eternal. Today we've got the oscillating universe theory or steady state theory. They believed that the universe was infinite. Today they say it's unbounded. They thought the earth and the universe were ancient. Today we're told it's 13.5 billion years old and the earth is 4.6 billion years. They thought there were countless worlds. Today we've got the multiverse theory and the search for alien life out there someplace. They thought everything evolved from chaos. Well, today the Big Bang theorists tell us that everything evolved from chaotic stardust. You and I are just stardust. There's a school of atomism where they thought everything happened by random chance processes. Today we've got things like the nebular hypothesis for the formation of the Earth, saying all the dust and gas particles just collided together from a ring of dust and gas around the sun and formed our Earth just by chance. They thought Earth was a living organism. Today we've got the Gaia hypothesis. They thought everything evolved, that is, life evolved from the Earth. Today we've got naturalism, and we talk about Mother Earth. Have you ever heard the expression Mother Nature? Well, I think that's where that comes from. They, at least some of them, thought everything was full of gods. Today, pantheism, especially on the New Agers, are especially into that. How about biological evolution? Again, they believed in spontaneous generation. Today they tell us life can come from non-life. It just takes a long time. They said that everything evolved from one substance, usually water. Today they talk about chemical evolution in the prebiotic soup. They thought that natural selection acted on random changes. Today it's natural selection on random mutations. They thought the first life came from the mud or the sea. Today they tell us from the prebiotic soup or primordial ooze. They thought terrestrial animals came from marine life. Today terrestrial animals came from amphibians, so they tell us. There was a struggle for survival that they saw. Today it's survival of the fittest. They thought life came together by some process of self-assembly. Well, today we're told that there's a self-organizing principle or property that somehow matter just likes to come together and organize itself into more complex forms, and the same with biological life. Where does that come from? Well, it's one of these so-called just-so stories. They can't figure out how it happened, so it must be a self-organizing principle. Other precursors to today's claims: sensation, the sole source of knowledge, materialism today. Only matter is real. Everything can be reduced to atoms, materialism and reductionism today. Fossils, evidence of geologic and biological change. Today, fossil record, a record of evolution. The great chain of being. Today, we've got evolutionary taxonomy, which attempts to classify animals according to their assumed evolutionary pathway. Interestingly enough, the only diagram that Darwin had in his book was the tree of life, purportedly showing how everything evolved from a few common ancestors. And finally, they thought civilization evolved, and so do we in anthropology. At least that's what they tell us. So if I was to diagram, in a simple diagram, their ancient beliefs and putting everything all together, this is kind of a broad brush, I guess I could say. Everything evolved from a watery chaos, giving us Mother Earth. The sun shining on the primal mud on Mother Earth caused the first life, which eventually crawled out from the ocean and gave us up. The only difference in today's theory is, instead of a watery chaos, we would say the chaos from the Big Bang. So you see, there's nothing new under the sun. This gave me a new appreciation for Colossians 2:8. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. According to the tradition of men, I'm beginning to see that evolution has a long, long tradition. And I believe that's one of the things that this scripture is referring to. Well, let's go on in history. I'm going to skip over very lightly the Middle Ages, just on account of time, but the beliefs during the Middle Ages were kind of a blend of Christian teaching and Greek philosophy. They were pretty static most of the time. They didn't change due to the influence of the Catholic Church, but a lot of the philosophers of the time stuck to a kind of a theistic evolution, especially when it came to spontaneous generation of lower life forms. They couldn't figure out where they came from. A couple of them insisted that Genesis wasn't to be taken too literally, lest science prove otherwise. Have we heard that before? Yes. Today, the theistic evolutionists tell us, well, we can't take Genesis literally because science has shown otherwise. And as I mentioned, the great chain of being persisted for a long time. Well, today we're in a place where there's a huge gulf between religion or theology and science. How did this start? Where did it begin? Well, I'm going to take us back to the time of the Renaissance, and let's just see how that line of thought became prevalent. I want to start with a quote from the 1981 resolution of the National Academy of Sciences, which said, "Religion and science are separate and mutually exclusive realms of thought whose presentation in the same context leads to misunderstanding of both scientific and religious belief." That's where we are today. The two cannot come together. You can have your religion, but keep it within your four walls, they tell us. But science, let's keep that separate. It has nothing to do with religion. And so this is the picture. Creation, that's just religion. Unprovable, feeling, mushy sort of stuff, you know. Evolution, oh, that's science, cold, hard facts. Not. And we're going to see exactly how that happened. How did we get to this state of affairs anyway? So we go to the Renaissance from the 14th to the 16th centuries. The Renaissance meant a new birth. It was a revival of learning, that is to say, a revival of the ancient Greek and Roman classics. So they were looking back to philosophers like Plato and Aristotle. They viewed Roman and Greek society as models for medieval society. And it was a rejection of Middle Age prejudices and attitudes and so forth, so they called them. And they said, well, those are just the Dark Ages. We're coming into the Age of Reason now. Well, there are actually two streams of thought that came out of the Renaissance. One was the Reformation, and this was an attempt to return to biblical Christianity. I don't have time to go into this very much. I'll just list a few of the reformers. You've probably heard of most of them, Martin Luther in particular. You probably remember that last year, 2017, was the 500th anniversary of the Reformation in Germany that was started by Martin Luther when he nailed his 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg. I'll just mention a couple of others. John Huss and Savonarola both gave their lives for what they believed in. The second train of thought was the humanistic side. So the Renaissance was actually mostly humanistic, called the Age of Rationalism or the Age of Reason, in which human reasoning was deemed to be superior to everything else. The emphasis here was on the humanistic side rather than on God. And as I mentioned, they modeled their thinking after ancient Greece and Rome, and the scale of being was kind of a symbol of it, I guess. And the Middle Age philosophers believed that society could turn people away from evil. If we just do the right things, we can reform society. But this humanistic thinking affected even the theologians of the time. As I mentioned earlier, there was a combination of Christian teaching and Greek philosophy. So if we were to diagram it out, it might look something like this. We start off with the Renaissance, rebirth of learning, which gave birth to the Reformation, an attempt to return to biblical Christianity. And it was the Reformation that produced the bulk of the scientists of the time. Most of them were Christians. We're going to look at a few of them in a minute. And so science started out being founded upon biblical principles, biblical concepts. And so I'm just going to point out very briefly a few of them, a few of the more famous ones. Leonardo da Vinci was perhaps the first one. I always think of him in relation to aerodynamics because I'm a pilot. So, but also Johann Kepler, who stated, "Science is thinking God's thoughts after him." Another series here, perhaps the most famous of all, Isaac Newton. We've all heard of him in relation to calculus and so forth, but did you know that he wrote more works on theology than on science? And yet today, these works are largely forgotten. Nobody remembers his writings on theology. So how did this split begin? Well, it probably began with William of Ockham, who was a 14th century English philosopher. You may have heard of Ockham's razor, which comes from him. That says that the simplest explanation for something is probably the right one. Well, he drew a sharp line between natural knowledge on the one hand, which we call science today, versus revealed truth or theology, the Bible, on the other hand. Well, it didn't have much of an impact to begin with. Science was still pretty much founded on biblical concepts, but people started looking away from the Bible towards naturalistic explanations. A good illustration of this is found in the school of rationalism, typified by René Descartes. You may remember Descartes from algebra. We still use the Cartesian coordinate system. Well, Descartes believed in God. He thought there was an infinite and good God, but he also said that everything can be explained by mathematical laws. However, this sounds contradictory, but he also said, yet it's not possible to be certain of anything. Well, this sounds to me a lot like postmodernism, which says we can't be sure of anything. We can't be sure anything is right because we can't possibly have all the facts on any one issue. And so we don't really know anything. That's what they say. But he also said that to become rational, that is, to know what's right and what's wrong, only requires education. That kind of reminds me about what's going on today. We're told that if we just pour enough money into the public schools and get everybody educated, society will be okay. We'll solve all of our problems. Well, how well has that worked? Another rationalist was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And he said that progress in the science and science and the arts contributed to the corruption of humanity. He thought that people became evil when they lived close together in a society, and when people were spread out living closer to nature, they were less corrupted. So it was society that corrupted people. Well, virtually all the philosophers of that age believed in the superiority of reason and knowledge. Their slogan became, "Knowledge is power." And this was an age where they thought reason versus ignorance, superstition, and uncritical acceptance of authority, reason comes out on top. Now, this is partly a backlash against the abuses of the Catholic Church. It reminds me of these bumper stickers that used to see around question authority. Well, they were questioning authority back there, particularly the authority of the church. And it was an age where there was a worship of reason. They said that only reason can yield universal truths. We have the capacity to distinguish the true from the false all by ourselves. Therefore, we don't need the Bible. We don't need the religion at all. And so some of these philosophers went to the point where they wanted to get rid of religion at all costs, get rid of it all, throw out the baby with the bathwater. And a lot of them were either deists or atheists. Not many were Christians. Along with this, we have the rise of materialism. Oh, but we've seen that before, so this is nothing new. So it's coming back again with Thomas Hobbes typifying it, saying all is material. Well, that's what the Greek philosophers were telling us. Everything can be explained by scientific laws, very similar to what Descartes was saying. But he also said that humans don't have a spiritual nature. Well, that goes along with materialism, saying that everything is material, it's just what we see and hear and so forth, we can sense. So the biblical basis for science is now starting to weaken a little bit. People are starting to question the authority of the Bible. This was the age of the worship of reason. And on the heels of that, or actually overlapping it a bit, was empiricism. Now, I mentioned that earlier, typified by David Hume, a Scottish philosopher. He said that experience is the most important source of knowledge. Again, very materialistic. And he said, we can't base our decisions on any other sources, especially the Bible or governmental authority. Again, question authority. So as empiricism and rationalism, the age of reason, start gaining acceptance, we see an erosion, a further erosion to biblical authority. Well, along with that came the so-called Enlightenment. They were being enlightened, so they thought, and throwing away the superstitions of the Dark Ages. This was an emancipation from superstition and prejudices of earlier times. And in essence, it was a rejection of biblical authority, a rejection of Christianity. They thought human reason, again, was all important, and they were starting to come up with new theories, usually evolutionary theories, to explain the origins of heaven and earth. And so they said, once we become enlightened, society's problems would be solved. Sort of reminds me of Confucius or Buddha sitting under a tree waiting for that enlightenment to come. Well, all of this set the stage for Charles Darwin coming in the future, who was preceded by the school of uniformitarianism. Most of you have probably heard of that, but in case you haven't, uniformitarianism says that all geologic processes take eons of time. Everything's very slow. And they came up with a slogan, "The present is the key to the past," which says that whatever's going on geologically now is what's always gone on for eons of time. The wearing down of mountain ranges and wearing down of continents and filling up of the oceans by the rains and so forth, very, very slow. And therefore, it takes lots of time, so the earth must be old, and therefore there was no Genesis flood. James Hutton came up with this concept in the late 18th century, followed by Charles Lyell, who wrote a three-volume book in the 1830s called The Principles of Geology. All of this set the stage for Charles Darwin. Uniformitarianism came along, and Darwin saw it as an opportunity for him to develop his theory. During his famous five-year voyage on the HMS Beagle, he took Lyell's book, The Principles of Geology, and read it. By the time he got through, he threw away any belief he may have had in the Bible. You may recall that he had a degree in theology. That was his only degree, actually. But he completely chucked it overboard. He became a student of Lyell's, and eventually they became friends. Lyell was one of the ones who encouraged Darwin to publish his Origin of the Species. And of course, Darwin said that everything evolved from a few common ancestors, and natural selection and survival of the fittest, as if that was anything new. But as we've seen, that idea is thousands of years old. Now, was Darwin aware of what these ancient philosophers thought? To some degree, perhaps. He apparently read some of Plato and Aristotle. It was only in later editions of his book, however, that he grudgingly gave credit to his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, for helping him develop some of his ideas, and he gave credit to a few others. But in any case, the vast amounts of time required gave him the opportunity to develop evolution, because evolution takes lots of time. So now, the biblical basis for science has been eroded. It's now becoming founded on evolution. Well, there's a couple more isms I want to throw out before we finish tonight. Naturalism, which we've seen before, but it rose up again in the 1890s in a slightly different form. Again, they said, knowledge is only acquired through the five senses, but they added something. They said that everything people do is determined by heredity or the environment. In other words, it's not my fault I did that. It's bad genes. Bad genes made me an alcoholic or whatever. Or it's the environment. It's society's fault. It's the way I was raised. I didn't do anything. That sort of attitude. They again emphasized the physical world and totally excluded anything supernatural. Jack London was a typical writer of this period. He wrote things like The Call of the Wild and White Fang. White Fang, I know, was made into a movie, and I think Call of the Wild was too. Did any of you ever see the movie White Fang 1? It comes across as kind of an adventure story and sort of enjoyable. But I went back and I tried to read the book, White Fang, and I just couldn't get through it. London was a socialist and an atheist, and his books are very dark and pessimistic. They're characterized by brutal realism, which is carried over into the movies today. He popularized the phrase red of tooth and claw. He very much was an evolutionist, and it shows through in his books. Another, well, this mix of naturalism and Darwinism and everything contributed to the erosion of scriptural authority and added into the mixture. One more ism, Romanticism, was a popular train of thought going back a little bit to the late 18th, 19th centuries. And they emphasized feeling over reason. This was kind of contradictory towards the earlier emphasis on reason, but it was kind of all added into the mixture. And it reminds me of what's going on today. Feelings seem to be all important. We can't hurt people's feelings. Individuality and lack of discipline were emphasized in that sort of writing. Individual rights reminds me of the civil rights movement. I'm not saying it was all bad, but I think it went overboard in some areas. And they viewed, again, nature as living. Once again, the Gaia hypothesis. And you may not think of Edgar Allan Poe as a romanticist, but he was of that genre when you think about his emphasis on feelings and things like that. There was another writer that you've probably heard of, James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote things like The Last Mohican. He, among other writers, brought forth the concept of the noble savage, and this goes back to the rationalism of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said that civilization corrupts. It's the cities there where people, you know, are supposedly civilized, but that's actually corrupting people, and it's the uncorrupted people living out in the wild, the noble savage, that we're to look to, who are uncorrupted. Well, Anyway, all of this, Romanticism, naturalism, Darwinism, has funneled its influence into the last ism that I'll bring up tonight, moral relativism. I'm sure you've heard of that, sometimes called relative morality, in which there are no absolutes. This is typified by Jean-Paul Sartre, a French philosopher who died in 1980, but he said that there is no absolute truth. All truth is relative. And he also said the world is meaningless. Well, if evolution is true, we're just accidents in space. Of course, it has no meaning. And he also said that we each can operate according to our own moral code. What's right for me might not be what's right for you, and vice versa. So if everybody just lives out their own lives with their own moral code, we'll be fine. It's interesting that my dad was into existentialism, which is the kind of goes along with moral relativism, I guess we could say. And it's very depressing. He was very depressed, and he even tried to commit suicide, and this is what this kind of thinking can produce. And so we end up with Charles Darwin, who said, a man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best. In other words, do whatever you think is right. If it feels good, do it. Remember that saying from the hippies of the 60s? No moral compass, and that's what Michael Denton said in his book, Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. It was because Darwinian theory broke man's link with God and set him adrift in a cosmos without purpose or end that its impact was so fundamental. Not that Darwin said anything new or original, but because society had been prepared for the release of his book. They were waiting for something besides the Bible to explain nature and our origins. As I mentioned, it didn't start with Darwin, as we've seen. The roots of evolution go back, way back in history. And it seems like whenever a society, a people reject their creator, evolution rears its ugly head up to take his place. But we don't have to live a meaningless, purposeless existence, do we? 2 Peter 1:16, for we did not follow cunningly devised fables, i.e. evolution, when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And finally, Titus 1:2, we have hope. Hope of eternal life, which God, who cannot lie, promised before time began. Well, I hope that sheds some light on things. Thank you for your attention.
Let's give Bruce.